You're listening to Mockingbird. This recording was made at the 8th Annual Mockingbird Conference, held at Calvary St. George's Church in New York City.
Well, I think it's 10:45, so we'll get started. First, thank you all for being here. This is my first time speaking at Mockingbird, and I know a lot of our breakout speakers have kind of a following, so I've had these nightmares of the empty room for about the last month. What I learned today, though, is I could have just played amongst myself had I been alone in here. And you know, even Christy, my wife, was like, these all sound pretty good. So, but I think part of the marriage compact is she's here with me today. So we're going to do something real quick for me in my research. I want you all to close your eyes for a moment, please. Everybody, close your eyes for just a second. And I want you to raise your hand if you think greed is a problem in our society and in our nation. Just hand up if you think greed is a problem. Okay, wonderful. Hands down. Now I want you to raise your hand if you say, I am greedy. Okay, great. All right, thank you very much. That's very helpful. Okay, eyes open. All right. Just a quick introduction. I am Ted Schofield, and I am an author of a book called Eat What You Kill. And here's the hardback. It's up on the book table right now. St. Martin's published it last year. The paperback is coming out this week, which I'm really excited about. And in the course of doing book signings and doing research for the book, I was asked a lot of questions about the themes of the book. And one of the major themes of the book happens to be greed. The story is about a Wall Street guy who does very bad things for money. And even though it's a fiction book, you know, I did quite a bit of research on greed, and I came across some really fascinating data that I'm going to share with you. And then we're going to do a little bit of small group discussion where you're going to help me, and then we'll kind of draw some conclusions and see where we are after all that. But before we get started, I want to tell you, I get asked a lot of questions when I bring this up about, you know, am I holier than thou? You know, am I here to say I'm not greedy and you are, or I'm better and you're worse? And the answer is absolutely not. In addition to being a writer, I'm also a semi-reluctant securities attorney with an MBA in finance who bills clients far too much, you know, by the hour for my time. So, and in college, I had two posters on my wall at Vanderbilt University. One was a procession carrying a casket across the lawn in front of this huge mansion with a helicopter and cars. And it was this great poster, and it said, "He who has the most toys when he dies wins." That was one of the posters on my wall. And the second poster was this beautiful mansion with five cars underneath it in this underground garage. And it said, "Justification for higher education." So there you go. So certainly there's no holier than thou attitudes coming at you from up here. So real quick, the first thing I want to do is talk a little bit about the data that kind of set me down this path. How did I get interested in this topic of greed, other than the fact that it's a major theme of my book? And, you know, first off, you know, as a culture and as a society, we're quick to say that greed is a problem. I mean, I think every hand in this room just about was raised. There might have been one or two people who were sipping coffee, possibly. But, and you know, I did a Google search months ago, and just a few of the things that came up. Human civilization will collapse unless the greed culture is stopped. That was a headline in the London Telegraph. This is from Psychology Today. Greed undoes family and community and undermines the very values on which society and civilization are founded. Greed is killing America, the Huffington Post declared last year. Unconstrained greed is the heresy of our times. If it is not restrained, then the consequence could well be the total collapse of our society. That's from a British intellectual named Stuart Sutherland, who wrote that in 2014. Greed is more than simple avarice. Greed robs and hurts and even kills people. That's from Pastor Dwayne Westerman. So the pundits in the news, we hear this message that greed is B-A-D, bad. So then we look at the polls. What do we think? You know, what do we think as people? That's what, you know, that's what the press is telling us in many ways. There was a Vanity Fair poll last year where 78% of Americans disagreed with Gordon Gekko when he said greed is good. Only 19% said greed is good. A recent Marist poll said that 74% of Americans think business decisions based on greed are morally wrong. This is my favorite. Zogby conducted a very large benchmark poll, big sample size, very low margin of error, where greed was picked as the number one most urgent moral problem in America. Poverty and economic justice finished in second place. And way down the list were some of the other things that you can imagine, abortion and same-sex marriage. Greed was number one, the most urgent problem in our country. Back 10 years ago, there was a national Gallup survey that revealed that 75% of us believe that Americans put too much emphasis on money. And a poll of economist readers asked, what is the deadliest sin? So what do you think is the deadliest sin? And greed ranked number one. Finally, and this is just some new news that I find interesting, we have grown weary and dubious of all the technology upgrades. For the first time in a 15-year history of this poll, now more than half of us believe that the reason for Apple updating iPhones and for Microsoft putting out a new Windows version, it's no longer to make our lives better. The poll now shows that we answered it's for greed. So we're shifting a little bit about why we're being fed all these wonderful technology upgrades. So yes, we think greed is indeed quite a problem in our world. But wait for it. Are we greedy? And with our eyes closed, this crowd was actually pretty self-aware. I was impressed, I think, because usually it runs about 3 to 8% of people when I lecture on this. Even college students, so, you know, you see it's kind of idealistic. You get no hands in the air, basically, for the are you greedy. We had a pretty good show of hands here. So are we greedy? And we heard when I started the talk, we heard about kind of what the headlines tell us. But what we hear from other people, like my pastor, Tim Keller, says, even though it is clear that the world is filled with greed, almost no one thinks it is true of them. They are in denial. Mark Putman, who's the president of the Global Ethics University, said, ask anyone the question, are you greedy? And most will deny it. There was a big BBC poll conducted, and they asked two questions. Which sin have you ever committed? And which sin have you committed in the past month? Guess what was last on the list? Greed. Last on the list. Ever committed. Two fascinating data points here. The Catholic faith gives us two really interesting studies. In a Vatican research study on confessions, Catholic priests reported that greed was the least common deadly sin reported by men, and it tied for second. I mean, it tied for the least deadly sin with women. It tied with sloth, because Catholic moms are just far too busy, I think, to be lazy. So there was also a poll on a Catholic dating site that said, of the seven deadly sins, which deadly sin do you struggle with the most? Greed was, once again, last on the list. 2.7% of the 1,000 Catholic singles admitted to being greedy, whereas 47% admitting to being horny and struggling with lust. 47% said lust. 2.7% said greed. So this is just, it's across the board. I have yet to find any research that counters these two consistent data sets. Collectively, we recognize greed is something horrible in our society. Individually, it's not our problem. So I was curious, just with my having all this data that's kind of very third party, I did a SurveyMonkey, and I put it up on Facebook and LinkedIn, and I tweeted it to my, you know, I threw it out there. And so the people that responded, I had to cut it off at 500 or I had to pay SurveyMonkey more money. So the people that responded were, frankly, a lot of people like me. You know, my law school friends, my high school friends, you know who's up in your social networks. And I asked them, I believe I have a problem with, and click which of these things you have a problem with. So 30% said anger, 30% said envy, 28% said gluttony, 24% said they had a problem with pride, 22% had a problem with lust, 18% lazy, 8% greed. So that confirmed kind of all of this other data that I had gathered, even my group of friends, which I guess it shouldn't surprise me. But so in some of those polls on collective greed, they also flip when they're made personal. I mentioned that national Gallup survey where 75% of people said that greed is a real problem in our country and there's too much of an emphasis on money. That same sample of people, a full 80% said that they wanted to own a beautiful home, a new car, and other nice stuff because it was absolutely essential to their happiness. That same group of people, when asked why they chose their present career, guess what the number one answer was? Money. Absolutely. So here I am having put out a new book and talking to book clubs and being aware of these two very interesting group, the sets of data. And I wanted to write something about it. I had this kind of aha moment. Aha! Collectively, we think greed is a problem. Individually, it's not my problem. So I sat down to write a piece on this for Mockingbird, actually, about a year ago. And, being an author, I thought, well, I should put in a couple sentences about what greed is. If I'm going to really talk about this. Because I wanted it to be very clear to everyone that I'm not talking about greed for my children's love or greed for life. You hear these things. I was talking about good old-fashioned greed. Greed for money. I shouldn't say that. In my research, I don't really think there is greed for money. None of us do anything for money. You don't cash your paycheck and put it on your mantle and say, there's my pile of money. We all earn money because of the stuff it represents that it can get us. We might put it in the bank for 20 years, but that's because it's going to pay for our children's college education. So we don't want the money. We want something that it represents. So what we're talking about today is really greed for possessions, greed for stuff, greed for what money will get you. So I had this aha moment, these two great data sets where I could write this great article, and then I could not define greed. So my aha moment went from an oh no moment. So I did what we all do. I Googled it first and, got all the basic dictionary.com and free dictionary this and all these different things, and it wasn't helpful. I looked at the Bible, looked at Luke 12, where, Jesus says, be on your lookout against greed, and I looked at Colossians, and, what I learned there was kind of the very theologically rich answer Paul called greed idolatry. But in terms of us as a culture, dealing with greed, I was looking for something that's as simple as defining anger. If you shout at your children and beat your spouse, you've got an anger problem. If you'd rather sit at home and not go to work and live off the fat of the land, you've got a laziness problem. I wanted something like that, and I could not do it. So that's what set me down this path on researching greed and talking about greed. So I want your help now. So what I would like to do is for about maybe 5 or 6 minutes, if you could just turn and introduce yourself to a couple people that you're sitting around and help me come up with a general kind of secular definition of greed. All right. Who will volunteer to give me their group's answer? Anyone? Can we have a... Okay. All right. Class, attention. Okay, we have a volunteer to give us your...
I took notes for our group.
Oh, thank you. Okay.
Okay, our definitions. We have numerous, but first one, we don't want to know the definition because it threatens our comfort.
Okay. I agree. Okay.
However, if we are going to try to define it, we're all going to define it in a way that makes us not agree.
Okay. That's the conclusion, darn
yes,
it.
Yes. Okay. So, okay. First one, we think greedy is just being having a lack of content, not being content with what you
okay.
Another is seeking money in a way that hurts others. Another is a never-ending pursuit of always wanting more.
Okay.
And
wow.
Another is just a reluctance, no matter how much you have or whatever, just a reluctance to give anything to anyone.
Okay. All right.
And then one more. Sorry.
Okay. Okay. Great. Okay. Well, you did a lot there. All right. Somebody else. If it's the same, you can,
just turning your back on God and your neighbor.
Okay.
Hating God and your neighbor.
All right. Yes. Okay. That's a good one. I'm going to write that one down.
You want to write mine?
I got yours. Okay, someone else.
Is there greeted an insatiable and relentless drive for more.
Okay, great. Okay. Fantastic.
So we had more of a free-flowing conversation, okay. But we talked about in the sense where God says, or Jesus says, you can't serve God or mammon, you can only have one master. By turning to mammon, turning to this universal buying power, you're turning on yourself, your own resources. So greed is a shift to kind of drawing these concrete lines of keeping your own resources versus mm-hmm. turning to a gracious God who can give you everything that you need. Mm-hmm. Okay. So, like this gentleman was saying,
yeah,
the pagan God, your own neighbor.
Right.
He said it was an obsession with upward mobility.
Ah, okay. Obsession with upward mobility. Okay. Okay. Yep. All right. I'm going to write that one down. Great. Anybody else? Yes.
You used the term idolatry.
Yes.
Maybe you said that. I'm a latecomer to that. You did.
Yes. Well, I said we would get there. So we were kind of looking for kind of more of a secular, easy, you know, we all can define anger in a sentence. We can define lust in a sentence. We can define sloth in a sentence, but greed eludes us. So that's kind of the exercise. Okay. Yes.
Greed is fear of never enough.
Great. Great. Thank you. Okay. Wonderful. So we got most of what comes up. So in my experience lecturing on this topic and teaching everyone from college students to badgering my friends and family, a lot of these themes come up. And the first one that we heard from a couple of different groups is probably the most obvious in the biblical one, which is abundance. You know, we learn in Luke 12, watch out, be on your guard against all kinds of greed, for a man's life is not defined by the abundance of his possessions. So it's this notion of too much. And absolutely, I mean, I don't think any of us would disagree that that is a hallmark of greed. But I guarantee you that within your small groups here, and certainly us in the room here, we could not possibly agree on what consists of abundance. What is too much? If you're a parent with children, is a three-bedroom house too much? You could own a smaller home and give more of your money to people who need it. Is two cars too much if you have two teenage drivers? Because wow, you really only need one car. Someone could take the bus. So my point is, throughout the rest of our discussion, my point is not to say that anyone is right or wrong. It's could we take any of these factors that we've identified in this room and reach a consensus on it? And what you will hear me argue as we go on is that I think the answer is no. So the first is abundance. Okay, we all agree that certain people who have far too much stuff are probably greedy, but what is too much stuff? And if anyone has a thought on that, please just chime in and let me know. But again, I don't have the answer. That's what fascinates me about this topic. Something else we heard was this notion of satisfaction. In fact, I heard a group say very emphatically, if you can't be satisfied. And this notion of satisfaction often comes up. And studies show, this blows my mind, studies show that people, regardless of their income, we're talking about groups that were polled who make $30,000 up to groups who make $250,000, all think they would be happy if they had about 10% more. So if someone making 30 says, wow, if I just made an extra $3,000 or $5,000, I would be in good shape. Someone making $250,000 says, wow, if I could just get another $25,000 or $30,000 a year, I would be fine. We aren't satisfied. And a psychologist said in Psychology Today, the object of desire is no longer satisfaction, but desire itself. And I think, you know, in our consumer-driven culture, we are taught to desire, whether or not it's really going to satisfy us or not. But once again, though, satisfaction. I think all of us in this room would agree that there is an element of not being satisfied that makes a human greedy. But can we agree on what we should all be satisfied with? Would it be possible for our culture to say, okay, if you're single, you should be satisfied with a studio apartment and a very economical car, because then you can take the rest of your money and help others with it? I mean, is that possible? So I think, once again, satisfaction is one of these kind of universally identified elements of greed. But there's absolutely no way we would universally agree on what we should be satisfied with. Another one I heard, this word wasn't used, but it was definitely thrown about, is utility. I hear this so often. How do you use your money? You can make all the money you want, but if you use it in the right way, you just can't possibly be greedy. How do you use your money? Do you give it away? Do you help people with it? And the great example for this one, there's two. But one, we'll take the hypothetical billionaire. A single woman has made $5 billion and she's given $4 billion away to the best charities, the best Christian charities, helping starving children. Is that person greedy? Show of hands, she gave away $4 billion. Greedy or not greedy?
We're all greedy.
Yeah, no one wants to commit to that because you know where we're going. She kept a billion. Yeah. Does anybody need to keep $1 billion? And when I have pushed college students on this, you know, the hands go up. Oh, she's not greedy. She gave away 80%. I'm like, okay, great, good. And then the hands go up. She is greedy. She kept $1 billion. I'll say, okay, I just want to talk to you folks. What did she have to give away where you would say she's no longer greedy? She gave away 80% of her net worth. You know, what did she keep? Well, how many children does she have? I'll say, well, she's got no children. She's a single woman. Okay, I'll have college students tell me, well, you know, she may need $10 million. She should have given away $4.995 billion. I'm like, okay, $10 million, why? Well, you know, in economics, we learn that she can invest that and make 8% a year, and I think on that kind of income, she could live just fine. You know, it's just fascinating where people will go. And there's there's no consensus on utility. How do you use your money? One that comes up when I'm talking to my New York friends is the wonderful Koch family. Some people have very strong opinions on the Kochs and what they do. They recently gave $65 million to the Metropolitan Museum of Art to build that new plaza out front and the fountains and all that. And my wife was walking through the plaza the other day and heard some, correct me if I'm wrong, some women saying, Koch Plaza, I don't even want to sit in these chairs. You know, they're horrible people. They've also given $25 million to the United Negro College Fund. They've given $100 million to New York Presbyterian. These are some people who really do good things with their money. Are they greedy? Well, you know, I think we probably all might be divided on that one as well. So abundance, satisfaction, utility, three factors that I think we all identify are elements of greed, but I just can't imagine that as a culture we could come to a consensus on where that dividing line is between not greedy and greedy. Another topic that we heard come up is vocation, kind of this notion of how did you earn the money? Are you a hedge funder who takes over companies and fires people, or are you an electric battery creator that's going to, you know, end coal and oil use in the world? If you've made $1 billion that way, well, you're not greedy. But if you've made $1 billion through being a hedge funder, you probably are greedy. And you know, once again, this notion of vocation. Maybe some of us can agree on what's a greedy profession to be in, and some of us say, well, maybe not. But I don't think we could reach a cultural consensus, once again, on kind of which vocations make you greedy and which vocations don't. We also heard this notion of necessity. Wanting more than you need is a simple definition of greed, a scholar once said. And I think that resonates with us. If you want more than you need, you're greedy. Okay. Let's get two of us in this room to agree on what we need. Yeah. I mean, it's an impossible standard for us to agree on. And I was in Louisville, Kentucky, my hometown, over Easter, and my mother and I went to Easter dinner with this wonderful family, and they have four children, and they struggle. I mean, they struggle, and they struggle to pay the bills. They're everywhere, four children and two working parents. And I was talking to the young mother about this topic and about need, and she is insisting that she needs a 5-bedroom house and at least 2 cars to get her children where they have to go. And anything less than that would be inadequate, and she's not greedy for needing that. And I'm certainly not gonna argue with her. You know, I live in I'm sure my apartment rent is twice what her 4-bedroom house mortgages, so I'm not one to argue. But I just found that fascinating. You know, would an Indian mother with four children who, you know, would she say, I have to have a 4-bedroom house? And so this notion of need leads us to, on that topic, this kind of relativity. I didn't hear that from the group this morning, but that comes up often is it's relative. What's greed in the United States of America may not be greed in the slums of Brazil. So is greed relative? And could we agree on that? Could we agree that, well, if you live in New York, you're not greedy if you spend $6,000 a month for an apartment, but if you live in Des Moines, where you can get the same apartment, you shouldn't have to spend $6,000. It's another factor where we're just absolutely not going to reach a consensus. Another topic that comes up often is this notion of earned. Did you earn your money? There was a New York Times poll of unemployed men, and it was revealed that 44% of the men polled had chosen not to take jobs that were available in their area because the job did not pay enough incrementally over what they were getting in benefits. So 44%, and that caused a bit of a hailstorm in the blogosphere and especially in right-wing circles. You know, there's proof right there. There's proof that these welfare freeloaders are greedy, they're bad for our nation, they could be working, they're choosing not to, they didn't earn this money, and I actually read a comment saying they are greedy because they are sitting back taking benefits from the taxpayers when they could be working. Wow. You know, are we going to agree on that as a society and as a culture? So all of these different factors, oh, there's one more that didn't come up today either, but I hear this one mostly from lawyers. It's not greedy if it's legal. And, you know, in many ways, you know, I thought about that. And our first reaction, I heard the groans. Our first reaction is, no, that is way, way too low a bar. But is it the reality that we, in so many ways, our culture celebrates people who make a fortune legally? I mean, Bernie Madoff was a hero until he wasn't. You know, you celebrate that this guy is consistently making 10% a year for all of his clients, and wow, you know, and then all of a sudden it turns out that what he was doing was illegal, and now he goes from hero to goat for that reason and that reason alone. So I think even though we kind of all dismiss that notion of legality, there's probably a little bit more of that belief out in our culture and our nation than we want to admit. So from all of these factors that have come at me, and you guys did a great job coming up with the bulk of them, I have learned that I don't have the answer. I've learned that to come up with a consensus, to come up with a definition of greed that we can apply to not only our nation, but to ourselves, is far, far harder than we probably all thought when we walked in this room. Certainly far harder than I thought when I had that aha moment where I thought the very simple answer to these two different data sets was, we're just in denial. We're in denial. But I think it's far more nuanced than that. And speaking of a clean slate and what our topic is at this conference, how can we have a clean slate? How can we cleanse ourselves of the guilt of greed if we can't define it, if we don't know that we're greedy? And that topic absolutely just fascinates me and troubles me in so many ways. So we get to the thesis, which I heard. The thesis came out already. Oh, it was from back there in the back. We define greed individually, this is my thesis, so that we just remain outside its grasp. Think of greed as a circle, and we're just individually hanging just outside of it. And as we evolve, as we become more wealthy, as we become parents, as we get bigger homes and bigger apartments and nicer things, we just keep redrawing that circle. So we just stay just outside of it. And how do we move forward as a culture and as Christians when we have such a hard time admitting to defining greed, when we are much more likely to say that person is greedy and I'm not? So at that point, I just want to take a moment to hear any comments or yes.
Well, I don't think it's a quantity thing. I think it's a quality thing. Right. I think we've all experienced the last potato chip in the bowl.
Right.
Or there's just a little bit of ice cream in there, and I'm going to go get it before my wife gets it or the kids get it. So it's a heart issue.
Yeah.
And throughout 1 John 1:8, if we say we have no greed, we deceive ourselves.
Right.
If we confess our greed, God will cleanse us. So I think, it again, it's a separation issue from God. It's a heart issue that we're going to go it on our own.
Right.
So the quantity thing, I think, is just something that we cover up.
Right.
Because you say the point to the other.
Right. I agree. And it's that qualitative element that makes it so hard to define. Because it is qualitative. I think it is quantitative. It is not quantitative. On greed. You can probably put a number, if you will, on anger. One slap, one hit, you know, one horrible episode, you've got an anger problem. But with greed, it really does define quantification, without a doubt. So I've looked into kind of the $64,000 question, which is what we've ventured into now, which is why? Why is everyone greedy but me? Why do I define greed like this and just keep myself outside of it? And the first is what we just kind of brought up, is this the nature of greed. Most of us know when we have a problem with anger, Jesus didn't have to say, watch out for that sneaky adultery. We know when we're being lazy, we can look in the mirror and know that gluttony has arrived. But this notion of greed just kind of eludes us. I think that's just the nature of greed, unlike the other seven deadly sins and probably most of the other things that we can think of that we wish we didn't do. And then another factor, another differentiating feature of greed is I think a lot of us just instinctively believe that if we have more money and the more stuff that it buys us, we'll be happy. I mean, we hear retail therapy. You know, you've had a tough day, go shopping. This notion of retail therapy is, you know, I hear it a lot, frankly. But, you know, our reported level of happiness, and well, let me back up for a second. What the research shows is that, yes, if you are living below a very low level, if you are living in poverty, if you are getting all of your food because you're on SNAP, yes, a certain amount of money will push you into a higher level of self-reported happiness, but it stops there. In America, it stops around $35,000 a year for a single person. Above that, the happiness stops. There's no more incremental happiness for more money above a very low level, which people find very unusual. Collectively, our levels, our self-reported levels of happiness in America have not changed since 1957. It's a flat line. It dances around a flat line of about 13% roughly, where people will say, I am happy. And the same company asks the same question every year. So self-reported happiness in our country has not changed since 1957. We have the internet now. We have Netflix. Look at all these great things that we have, but we're not reporting that we're happier. The income graph, if you graph income on that same line with the flat happiness line, it of course just goes straight up. So as income has gone straight up, we have more stuff, we have more money, we don't report any higher levels of happiness. Oh, and this is an aside kind of. The same question is asked to other nations, not all of them. The people of India, Indonesia, Mexico, and Brazil last year all reported higher levels of happiness than Americans. So I think another factor that might play into why we don't want to define ourselves as greedy is our culture's perception of both money and materialism. And if you think about it for a second, what is our culture's perception of people with money and stuff? The other day I opened a newspaper here in New York City that I get every morning. And went to the social pages, because I don't know why, it's what I want to do with my coffee. And there was a picture of Kim Kardashian. Anyone know who she is, maybe? And this is what it said underneath the picture. Do you think Kim Kardashian is all butt and no brains? Think again. According to Forbes, this 34-year-old is worth $28 million. And she's got a whole lot more coming her way. So Kim Kardashian is not all butt and no brains because she is worth $28 million. She may be a Rhodes Scholar, I have no idea. I doubt it. She may be super smart and super intelligent, but I don't think she's super smart and intelligent because she's worth $28 million. But I read that and wouldn't have given it a second thought if I wasn't so obsessed with this topic. Author Laura Penny, she's a teacher. She's a high school teacher and an author. She recalls a time when she was talking about a piece of literature, and she compared Paris Hilton to one of the dim bulb characters in the novel. And one of her better students just immediately bristled and said, Paris Hilton must be smart. She's got all the money and attention. And the teacher concluded, if wealth is the ultimate measure of intelligence and money, the surest proof of brains, then Paris Hilton trounces low-earning losers like poets and philosophers. So we've got this cultural perception that money and stuff equals some sort of intelligence. Kim Kardashian's worth $28 million. She can't be all butt and no brains. And sure enough, there is some data that supports this cultural perception that we have. There was a Duke University study that came out last May. The headline on CNBC was, Billionaires Are Smarter, Study Says. And this Duke University study went on to find a correlation between wealth and intelligence. The British intellectual Stuart Sutherland that I quoted earlier, he's a tremendous opponent of greed. He actually supports what he calls name and shame. He wants greedy people to be named and shamed in newspapers, and he wants all tax returns to be made public within 5 years. Imagine all of our tax returns being made public so we could be named and shamed as greedy based on our charitable contributions.
But anger issue.
Yeah, he might have anger. But even Stuart Sutherland said that greedy people are perceived to have a matter of smartness and a tendency to cunning. So we've got this cultural perception that money and materialism means that we are smarter and more hardworking. There was a Pew Research poll of Americans, and a good poll with a very low margin of error. 43% of those polled said that rich people are more likely to be intelligent than average income earning people. Only 8% said less likely. The rest said no difference. 42% said rich people are more hardworking than the average American. And only 24% said less hardworking. So where this takes me, and I would love your feedback when I'm finished, where this takes me is maybe there's more to us drawing that circle and keeping us just outside of it than just kind of our own innate selfishness. What are we hearing from our culture? What are we hearing from the externalities that we're hearing is, well, if I'm greedy, that means I'll have more money and more stuff, and I'll be perceived as smarter and more hardworking. What impact does that have on our own perceptions of ourself and what we want to keep? You know, if I have more stuff, going back to the abundance issue, if I have a nicer car than my neighbor, maybe subconsciously I believe I'm perceived as more intelligent and hardworking than my neighbor. So any thoughts on that? Comments? Yeah.
So I think there's also at work, while that those things may be true, there's also a guilt complex about wealth that people feel like they need to talk about how much they're giving away or how much they're they don't want this stuff. I remember a couple of talking to, she's like, I don't need any of these things, blah, 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 and her husband rolled his eyes. I can just live with beach furniture. But I think that's at play. Because, so this is, we're all walking contradictions. We never live fully self-consistently. And I think really what's at issue is, there's a parable Kierkegaard gave where he said, well, imagine a woman with the two coins. What if she was mistaken about the coins? What if they fell out of her handkerchief and she threw that into the temple offering? Would she still given the same amount? Because there's a sense where, even the example you use about the woman who gave away $4 or $5 billion, mm-hmm. what was the point of that, and where was she getting? Sure. There's a sense where, oh, we give this money to charity, but what does that mean? Like, it's different to give your money to some nameless organization, or this faceless organization, sorry, than actually sitting next to someone and buying them a meal and sure. talking with them. And so I wonder if this greed is this, it's still, even in the charitable giving, so-called charitable giving, we're still focused on our own self and our own resources right. instead of opening our fists. I mean, like, yeah, maybe she should have given more. You know, there's that argument, right. oh, how much can she live on? But she could she give it all away? And could she really trust that she would be provided for?
Right.
I think that sort of feeds why it's like, yeah, we feel guilty about the things we own, but we think they're smart because they have all this stuff. Because of, you know, the Bible portrays characters like David or Solomon, who are extraordinarily rich, And yet there's no shadow on them because they have all this stuff. It's what kind of manifests out of how they're. So it's like, I don't want to give into that utilitarian thinking,
because
right. that can be kind of dark, but there's some sense to that logic, not just how you're using it, but how you're living it, I
right.
guess.
Right.
So I'm going to step off my soapbox.
No, great point. Great point. Yes, sir.
I think all this language we're using is the language of the liar and the deceiver, because mm-hmm. God promises abundance. I don't think in this world, he does say, beware of these people that read it, but in his kingdom, I don't think Queen Elizabeth is going to be disappointed in the mansion she's getting,
right.
or the
right.
king of Brunei.
Right.
No one is going to be disappointed with what they have, and they're going to live a life of abundance
right.
and all the other things that are described in heaven. So I really think all of this language is the language of the devil, and that we use that to both self-justify our position. Mm-hmm. But again, it's siding with wrong side, or as Jim said, choosing the wrong answer.
Right.
Can I put you on the spot?
Sure.
Okay. How would you take what you just said, which I think is absolutely 100% accurate, and how would you use that to determine if a fellow human being was greedy?
Well, I think we all have to recognize, as I said, that we are all greedy, and
right.
if we say we're not, we're deceiving ourselves. And
I agree.
That our only hope is in Christ and not in the world. And I'm going to fail every day at getting it right,
right.
But I have to recognize that I am failing.
Yeah.
That he's my only hope and not my portfolio or that last
right.
potato chip.
That's a great transition, and thank you for bringing up Nietzsche. In 1881, Nietzsche said, "What was once done for the love of God is now done for the love of money." And I think that's probably a good place for us to close, since lunch is coming up shortly. But yes, where my research is leading me, and I'm certainly still going down the path without a doubt, is that greed is about idolatry. It's a qualitative thing, not a quantitative thing. Maybe my quest for a nugget, a definition, a seed, maybe I'm never going to reach the end. Maybe it's my holy grail. But the Bible gives us great leadership and great insight on greed, and it's not as simple probably as most of us would like. There is no litmus test. There is no conclusion other than what Nietzsche said. If you have replaced the love of God with the love of money, then greed, money has become an idol. And it's just like all the other false idols that can get us. Any other comments or questions or thoughts?
You asked earlier about, I guess, owning a particular type of car. How does that reveal if we have pride that maybe I'm better than my neighbor? And I think the tricky thing for my own heart is this longing for more approval, because depending on what situation I'm in, I can look at a particular car I drive and say, okay, I'm better, I've worked harder, I've accomplished more than this guy. But then in another context, if I roll up to church on Sunday, I want the people at the church I worship that, and maybe say, oh, he has an older vehicle, like he's not as
right.
Whether I feel insecure because I don't have something as nice,
right?
Right, and I'm being judged or measured, or I want to be perceived as more
right.
humble when I give away, so I don't need the nicest new thing. And
yeah.
it kind of ebbs and flows based on circumstance.
So you drive the family truckster to church and you drive the convertible to work. Well, that's great. Yeah, that brings up, there's a couple theories about why our self-reported happiness levels have not changed since 1957. And they're both very dark, and I think they're both right, unfortunately. And one of them is kind of what's called the hedonistic treadmill. And that is, no matter what good new things we take in, whether it's the internet or a new car, we quickly adapt to it. It becomes our norm, and we want the next better thing. So in other words, we are satisfied with a new clothes or a new vehicle or a new home just for a very short time. So we're constantly on this hedonistic treadmill. That's the one theory of why we just can't get more happiness from stuff. And the second theory is just what he brought up. And that is that we are not happy unless we have more. than our neighbor. And by neighbor, I mean that we all have some peer group that we compete with. I think it is absolutely part of our human nature. I don't compete with, you know, I compete with people that I went to school with. I don't compete with people that went to different schools. You know, I don't think someone who works on an assembly line competes with a rocket scientist at NASA. In other words, we all have our own little group that we compete with, and it goes back to that 10%. Why do we just want 10% more? Well, we'll have 10% more than our peer group. So that's the other theory of why our happiness hasn't increased with all this much more stuff that we've gotten in the past 60 years. It's because everyone's gotten it. If I was the only guy who had the internet and all you people didn't, I'd probably be pretty happy. But we've all got it, yeah.
Do you draw a distinction between a person being greedy and a person being ruled by greed?
Do I? Certainly. Absolutely.
And
but I can't, I absolutely
do. What
would
you say that is?
That's what I can't define.
Because I think we would all say
yeah.
We're greedy.
Right.
But what does it mean?
Well, if you're ruled by greed, to me, it's the idol that's in your heart. You've placed money and materialism ahead of God. And that can, you know, as my pastor, Tim Keller, teaches, plenty of things that are good can become false idols. You can put the love of a spouse above God, and then when that spouse disappoints you, your world falls apart. You can put your children's happiness, you know, ahead of God, and your world falls apart when your children disappoint you. I think the same is with money. When you've put money and materialism and career ahead of God, then just the smallest thing that threatens those crushes you. So that's what I would say. If you're ruled by money, you're there. And that probably makes sense to all of us, but how do we reach that type of consensus in our culture other than converting every single human being to Christianity, which is the goal? Yes?
You know, I just recognize in my own heart, and my wife and I talk about this quite a bit, but I'm a terrible receiver of God's good gifts, recognizing that to receive it. But I'm a really good consumer. You know, what's in it for me?
Sure.
And for the getter, you know, me. That's really, maybe that draws some distinction.
Yeah.
And how can we not be in our culture? You know, we were even told that we have to consume to make America a better place. I mean, if you don't consume, you know, consumption is the engine that drives our economy. And what, that's the stuff. Get more stuff. You're going to make America better.
We're always pursuing outcomes.
Right. Sure. I remember, about a week or two after 9/11, Rudy Giuliani famously announced New York City is open for business. Come spend your money here. Come consume. That's what we needed at that time, apparently. We needed people to come spend their money in New York. So, yeah, I think to not be a consumer in our culture, I think, would take a tremendous amount of willpower, if you will.
Or even even President George W. Bush said, don't let the terrorists win. Go out, keep buying.
Right, right, keep buying, right, yeah.
So the reason why I want to dodge the bullet of being accused of being greedy is because there's a certain knowingness of greediness, there's an aggressiveness, mm-hmm. like I know what I'm doing, and I'd rather let my fear usurp that greed. It's more like, oh, I'm afraid I won't be able to support
pay my bills.
And so,
okay.
So that's sort of justifying myself. That's sort of saying, I don't know what I'm doing, I'm afraid. And so
right.
Greed implies I know exactly what I'm doing and I want more. Mm-hmm. And so I think it's interesting that in the Bible, it was mentioned a couple times that greed is rooted with fear, and we're told much more often to not be afraid rather than to not be greedy.
Right.
And so when I'm not afraid, then I'm more aware of what I've been given.
Right. That's I like that. I'm going to steal that if you don't mind.
Right.
So what I heard you say is that your greed is more passive. You know when you're actively being angry. You know when you're doing these other things that you shouldn't do. It's a much more active emotion. It's a much more active feeling.
Yeah.
But you can rest in your passive greed out of fear that if you do not pile up your treasures, if you will, bad things might happen.
Yeah.
Okay, that's good. Thank you. Fantastic. Anybody else? I think lunch is in 2 minutes, so thank you all again very much.